spent some time in South Africa volunteering as part of the ICS program. So this was run by a tier fund in association with a charity in South Africa called Zoe Life. Whereas this wasn't technically a mission trip, it had a lot of mission-based values on it. So we were working through a Christian charity in South Africa, and we were assisting a lot of the local churches where we were. So I was based in a small township called Marion Ridge, about 28 kilometers outside of Durban in KwaZulu-Natal. And this township has got an official population of about 10,000. However, the number is probably much higher due to people's understanding of what they mean in the census by living it somewhere. So we were doing a lot of different work out there. So we were had projects include, main projects were working with youth and young people. So I was mainly involved in the schools. So I was teaching three grade 10 classes, life orientation. So this covers anything from sexual reproductive health to careers and job hunting, to xenophobia, and it also included their sports lessons, which I did have to plan, which was weird because I don't do sports myself. And as well as that, in the school, we helped run the Student Christian Association a couple of times a week. So this was during the lunch times, we'd have about 50 kids come each session where we would play games with them, share testimonies, sing songs, and just be together in fellowship. And we were also, some of the rest of the team were involved in projects such as community gardening, working in very young childcare with the creche, and projects similar to that. And we also, over Easter, we ran a holiday club where we were aiming it from people in primary school age, which in South Africa is slightly different to what it is here, where it's, I think, from 6 until about 12. However, we did have people who were a lot younger and some older coming. And I think over the 2 weeks we were running it, we had about 267 people registered in total, and there were 11 of us running it. So it was rather manic. We were averaging 150 a day. So this would involve, we would be playing games with them and leading them in activities, the odd crafts activity, and then we would take them down to one of the local churches and do some, the theme of the holiday club was superheroes. And so we would take them to one of the churches and we would read them a story from the Bible of one of what we decided, a couple of the biblical superheroes, including Daniel and Gideon, and of course Jesus. And that was great, and we also had help from one of the other churches where they would make lunch for all of the, on average, 150 kids, and try and find something that that many young people would actually eat. And then, so that was a really great opportunity to share our faith with the people there who, although in Marion, where we're based, there were 22 churches, not everyone there believed, and there was a large proportion of them who didn't know what to believe or still believed in the old ancestral spirits and values such as that, which were interesting. And as you may have seen in some of the pictures up here, we also had opportunity, we had the weekends as free time, so we had recreational activities. We went to see a local rugby team play. We went to a market where I got this lovely shirt, which later turned out to be made in China, which I was not so pleased about. And we went to a nature reserve, and unfortunately, we didn't get to see many animals. I think we briefly saw a rock rabbit in the distance, and that was about as interesting as it got, apart from the monkeys, which were quite pest. But during our time out there, it wasn't all fun and games. We did have some difficult times. There were a few traumatic experiences, which I won't go into. But during that time, very early on, there were some scary times. And through that, it was quite weird because many people would have just pulled out at that moment, but through the whole time, we felt God's presence with us and supporting us. And one verse that helped us as a team so much was Jeremiah 29, verse 11, which is, "For I know the plans I have for you, plans for you to prosper, not to harm you." That was so helpful for us, and it just reminded us that where the bad things happen, God is also there, and he will make good of the situation. And towards the end of our trip there, we visited the local orphanage, which was amazing. The kids there were just so lovely, even though they were in a very difficult situation. Many of them had parents die or just walk out on them. And some of them actually did have parents, and they'd just been dumped in the orphanage because either the parents didn't want them or couldn't cope. And I've got a short video to play which shows some of the things we got up to with them. And it was just such a blessing to be there and see all of these things and experience the other cultures and the church in a different country. Thank you.
To come up. Lord, we thank you so much for everything that you give us in life, Lord, for the hard times and the good. And we look forward to hearing of your part in Leslie's journey. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. I'm going to start this evening just with a short passage of scripture, Judges 6, 36 to 40. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said." And this is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. But this time, make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew." And that night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. So when Toby asked if I could speak tonight, I immediately felt that I should share a little bit about what brought us from Zimbabwe to the UK. And I think that passage is really key to trying to get God's answer with really difficult questions when you're trying to make really difficult decisions. And God's hand was so apparent at every single stage of our move. It's going to be quite a challenge to fit it into a short period of time because God was so amazing to us. But I've tried to pick out some of the headlines to share with you. So just a bit about our background, really. On his father's side, Pete's family had been in Africa for three generations. His great-grandparents left Lincolnshire in about 1879 and moved to Africa. On his mother's side were members of the 1820 settlers to the Cape. That was on Pete's side. My father's Dutch, and he moved to South Africa when he was 4 years old. But my mother's side go back to Europe, but through both lines down each of my grandparents' side. They've been in Africa since about the 1670s, which is only about 20 years after Jan van Riebeck and the settlers, your first European settlers. So you can see that our history and family are quite well and deeply rooted in Africa, and we never imagined a time where we might leave. In 2000, we had something you've experienced here, an unexpected result of a referendum. But it meant there that the government realised that it was losing its very firm grip on the general populace, which had some quite serious implications for them. And it was the start of a really prolonged period of economic and political turmoil in Zimbabwe that continues today. Times really became quite tough on the ground over the next couple of years, at which point we had to, as parents, think, is this really some way that our children have a future? By 2002, when Mike was 8 and Colin was 4, we were queuing for just the basic essentials like fuel, bread, toilet paper, soap, milk. I actually got caught in a milk riot because there had been no fresh milk in the supermarket and it happened to arrive while I was in there. And it's quite easy to laugh about it now, but at the time it was really quite scary. The economy has just spiralled completely out of control. In 2002, inflation was 200%. It rose to 600% by the beginning of 2003. And in fact, it went on in 2008 to peak at 230 million percent. So when people moan about 2% inflation here, we kind of go, amateurs. As I say, you know, I had a couple of scary incidents where really I started to fear for my, our personal safety, even in the town where we were generally okay. But in the rural areas, the farmers were being murdered, they were being burnt out of their homes, and the things were getting quite serious. At this time, Pete was the pastor of our local Assemblies of God church. And what was encouraging, though, despite all the really hard times, and we were some of the more fortunate people, is that people were really relying on God, and people were turning to God rather than away from him to trust him for their day-to-day needs. We lived in the house where Pete had grown up with his dad, who had moved into the grandpa cottage, which was attached to the house. And we'd been praying for a long time about what direction that God was leading us in. And it had crossed our minds that we may have to leave Zimbabwe. But the question was, where on earth would we go? Literally, where on earth would we go? We discovered that we were entitled to UK ancestry visa through Pete's Scottish grandmother. We thought about places like Canada and New Zealand as well, who were being quite open to Zimbabweans who were leaving. And we eventually came to the conclusion that since I had a brother and sister here in Southampton, both of whom had been settled for about 15 years, that it would make sense rather to come here than to go even further away in the world. But of course, there were barriers. Pete's dad was quite elderly and he was starting to have trouble with his sight. And we didn't really want to leave him, but he wouldn't come with us. He said it was just too late in life for him to make such a big change. And but he was saying, I think you should go. He felt that we should move on. So finding somewhere for him to live safely was a really, big concern for us if we did leave. Selling his house would be difficult because so many people were leaving Zimbabwe that there was a real glut of houses on the market. The tricky one, my passport had expired a couple of years before. And it was virtually impossible to get a passport renewed in less than about 18 months, if at all. And getting an ancestry visa was not only really expensive, but it took about 6 months to process. And understandably, you can imagine the bureaucracy around that was quite intense. Pete's passport had a couple of years to run on it, but we also knew that the British authorities wouldn't be particularly happy putting a four-year visa onto a passport that had only 2 years to go. And also, the Zimbabwean authorities didn't really like renewing passports that hadn't actually run out. So there were lots of things going on. Air tickets were really expensive, costs were rising all the time. And we were really blessed by the support of our church and people around us, so that every stage we were just praying this through and we were just trusting that God would lead us, because we didn't know if this was the right thing or not. We didn't know if this was what we should do or whether we should stay there. People kept saying, oh, it's going to get better, it's going to get better. And of course, in hindsight, we realise it really isn't going to get better. It still isn't at this point in time. So we took a first step, which was really, there was no point in us even looking at anything if I didn't have a passport. So I was trying to find out whether I could renew my passport. I spoke to someone at work about it in passing, and he said, well, we could go out of Harare to a small place called Bundoora, which is where he knew somebody in the passport office, and he thought that if he went with us and he put in a good word, that they might somehow be able to speed up the process for us. The queues in town were literally several days long at that point. You would have to just put someone to hold your place in the queue or go and stand there yourself overnight for probably a couple of nights in order to even have any hope of getting to the front of the queue. So very early one morning, we trundled off to Bundoora, to the passport office, and there were about 20 people in the queue at 6 a.m., so we thought, right, we're off for a really, you know, we're off a good start. Eventually, the office opened, and my colleague went in to chat to his friends for us. And he said, well, I hope it'll work. And then he disappeared off to go and do some other business. And we stood there, and we waited. And we were probably the only white people in probably about a 20-kilometre radius, which was quite daunting, considering what was going on around us and the farms around us, because it was a little farming town. And then suddenly there was this chap at the back of the queue who spotted us. Obviously, we stood out. And he started being really aggressive. And he was swearing at us and shouting at us and hurling abuse at us. And he just went on for a while. And the security guard eventually wandered out and sort of tried to make him stop. And he wasn't stopping. So he wandered inside. And the next thing, we sort of beckoned to the front of the queue. Come, you know, yeah, you white people. Sort of, you know, they beckoned us to the front of the queue. And we were ushered into the boss's office. And he was like, well, you know, he's bothering you too much. What can we do for you? So I said, well, you know, really need to renew the passport. Had all the forms done. And he had a look at it. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's okay. And I was... a little bit sarcastically, we kind of put Pete's stuff on the table as well and said, I suppose you could also do that as well. He's kind of, yeah, okay. And, I mean, we were gobsmacked because we just, we just really hadn't thought that anything like that would happen. And then he was like, well, come back in 3 months. And again, 3 months versus the 18 or more that we were expecting seemed amazing. So that was really, I guess, our first open door. So the next day we... 2 months later, we got a phone call to say that our passports were ready. And we could come and collect them. You can imagine we got there pretty fast. So really, that was our second open door. And then we thought, right, well, we need to go and see about our visas. So we gathered all our papers together the next day, took time off work, and went into the British Embassy, expecting again to hand everything in and to go away and be called back in a few months when they'd given it due consideration, because these things take time. We queued for 5 or 10 minutes, had a bit of an interview at the counter where they looked at all our papers, and then he said, well, come back in 2 days. So I said, well, what must we bring back in 2 days? And he said, no, come back for your visas in 2 days. Again, and it turned out that coincidentally, we had picked the one day where it was the last day they were doing the visas by a particular system. And the next day, they were changing the whole system. They were getting more expensive. They were making it much more bureaucratic to do. And they just wanted to clean up the queue that day. So they were processing everything. Everyone who came in that day, they were processing immediately. Again, only God could have done that and opened that door for us. So we picked up the visas on that Friday. And at that point, it started to be quite real, you know. Wow. So we've pushed against these doors. We've fallen through these doors. These doors are open. So the next challenge was to think about, well, we have no money for air tickets at that point in time. And obviously our biggest concern was Pete's dad, Frank. And, what was he going to do? So we went back home with our new visas. And he said, oh, well, actually, he's been offered a place at a retirement home that specialised in people with sight problems. And so he could have his own room with a bathroom, and they would take care of all his other needs. And that, as far as he was concerned, we mustn't worry about him. That was, you know, we were then free to go. He was going to sell the house and move into this place. So we contacted an estate agent who came out immediately, had a look around the house and said, oh, I know somebody who'd be interested. Can he come and look at the house tomorrow? So, well, yes, okay. And this person appeared the next morning, and he had a look around the house, pulled out an enormous wadge of cash out of his bag. I mean, I'm talking like a block of notes about that size, which was, I think, at the time about $1 million. I mean, it's hard to equate that to real money because of inflation the way it was. And he plonked that on the table and he said, I want the house. This is a sign of my goodwill. Let's negotiate. And they then negotiated a price then and there. And the property systems work differently there. You can pretty much change ownership very, very rapidly. And I think within a week, he had bought the house. And it was... And, of course, so that solved that problem. So that was another door open. And then it was a case of, right, OK, well... And not only had he bought the house, he had said that we could stay there rent-free until we were ready to go, until the day we left. He did come in and start doing work in the house while we were still there, but actually he just said, just stay there, no rush. When you're ready to go, you go, and then we'll move in. And then, of course, our last thing really to remaining was our air tickets. And again, on the Monday, we went in to talk to the travel agent about tickets and discovered that all the prices were going up about 100% the next day. So if we could buy them immediately, we could have the old price. Oops, no money. We didn't really have enough for them. And so we went back, and our Pete's co-pastor at the time said, oh, I've got an account with that agency. You just buy your tickets, put it on my account, and then when the money comes through for the house, then you can pay it back, which is, in fact, what we did. So that was another door open. And so by this point, we had really totally understood that, yes, God did want us to leave Zimbabwe and God did want us to come here. I mean, all of that activity was over a period of about 2 months, which should really have taken 2 years. You know, in world terms, that's what it should have taken. And we arrived here with our 4 suitcases and not much else on the 3rd of February 2003. And God has really continued to bless us. Even though it was really hard to start with, it was very liberating to have to literally get rid of every single thing we possessed and start again. There's a whole other, I could talk for such a long time about the lessons we learned about possessions and things, because we did. We had to leave everything. And but through it all, God really, truly answered our prayers. He heard them. He answered in practical way. I've often thought it couldn't have been much clearer for us, barring an angel appearing and saying, go. which did mean that we had no doubt in our minds that this move was of him. And we couldn't doubt his plan. And we've never regretted coming here. So I'd just like to finish with Proverbs 3:5-6, which is, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways submit to him, and he will make your paths straight. Or as some versions say, he will direct your paths. So I would just really encourage any of you to put all your decisions, big ones, little ones, medium ones, into God's hands and let him take care of them. Sometimes putting out a fleece is appropriate. It seemed right for us at that time because it was such an obvious way of doing things. To say, well, if you want us to do this, Lord, you will do this. But no matter which way he talks to you, he will answer your prayers, and you will be able to hear from him if you put your trust in him, because he is the God of miracles.
Pete.
Thank you. So Toby has asked us to say a little bit about ourselves and maybe something that
you don't know about us. I think most of you know a little bit about my story at this point. One thing which I think you may not know is that a long time ago, I used to collect demotivational posters. This is one that I came across some years ago, and it's very appropriate. You know the motivational posters, you've seen them in boardrooms, you've seen them in schools, places like that. This is the other way around. This is a dose of reality. For the sake of the recording, there's a picture of a sinking ship. Mistakes, it says. It could be that the purpose of your life is only to serve as a warning to others.
Ouch.
So I'm going to amend that slightly as I tell you a little bit about what God has done for me. Some of this I've never actually shared with anyone before, a little bit later. Now, as you know, what some of you know, my story is that as a child, I had leukemia. For those who don't know, leukemia is cancer of the blood. Wow. Leukemia back then is not the same as it is now. Today, I believe there's about an 80% survival rate if you get it. Back then, it was 20%, so it's actually completely reversed. So, I was diagnosed with acute lymphatic leukemia when I was about 3.5 years old. I had bleeding gums, I had a cough that wouldn't go away, and I was eventually, my pediatrician eventually decided something's not quite right here. Now, in those days, Rhodesia, early 70s, was fairly backwards, even for an African country. So they sent off the blood tests and everything to South Africa, and it came back positive for leukemia. And in this, I will bless my parents because they kept every single little bit of paper that there was. So I'm able to scan some of them, as you can see up there. And on the bottom left there, you'll see findings suggest the possibility of Sarcoma lymphoma. There was absolutely no way of treating that in Rhodesia as it was then. There was nothing that they could do, so they phoned around, made some arrangements, and the world famous hospital, H.F. Verwoerd Hospital in South Africa, Pretoria, said yes, they would take my case. It was actually world famous for cancer treatment in those days. So, it was arranged that I would go to the H.F. Verwoerd Hospital in South Africa. And this is where God's hand can begin to be seen. Because on arrival at the hospital, they didn't want to admit me. You see, we were not South African citizens. My father was a civil servant, and with his somewhat meager pay, was able to scrape together enough to cover the costs. We could see this. They could see that, but they wanted a deposit in cash first. There is no way that my parents could get enough money in South Africa to admit me then. So after a lot of negotiating, they said, yes, okay, we will admit the child, me, if we have a guarantee by your employer that the costs will be met. But my father was a civil servant. Effectively, they were asking that the government would guarantee that my father would pay his bills. So, not really sure what to do about this, he decided to go and visit the Rhodesian embassy in Pretoria. Coincidence. About 2 minutes after he walked in, he noticed a door open behind the counter and somebody he actually worked with walked through the door. So after pleasantries were exchanged, said, what are you doing down here? It turned out that he was an accountant and he had come down to audit the embassy. So they got to talking, and my dad explained what was going on and the implications. So the chief accountant called over one of the minions and explained what was going on here, and they said, "We cannot do this." So he said, "Write it up on a compliment slip. The hospital will never know the difference." There it is. I think that is unique in the world where a government has guaranteed payment by an individual.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So while I was in hospital, my leukemia was brought under control. I was given several doses of chemotherapy, which left permanent marks on my teeth, and I was given radiation treatment a couple of times. I was given so much radiation treatment that they told my parents I would never have children. Look around, you'll see how that prediction worked. Eventually, I was pronounced in remission. I was allowed to go home, so we went back to Rhodesia. It was only a couple of months later that the remission failed, and I went downhill very, very quickly. I got the old cough back, and it was very serious, so serious that they didn't actually have time to get me back to South Africa. I was put in the infectious diseases hospital because they didn't have anywhere else to treat me in a specialist way. On top of the leukemia, possibly because of it, the cough developed a lung infection. And the drugs that I was on effectively took out my kidneys. My kidneys were only just working. My parents were offered a trial of a new drug that hadn't reached the market yet. It was still in the trial phase. It properly damaged my liver. It was the weekend, or the week running up to Easter, running up to Easter of that year. As it happened, Easter Sunday was also going to be my birthday. My parents were worried that I wouldn't see it. On Easter Friday, my hospital called my parents and said they didn't think that I was going to make the weekend. They better make some arrangements. In desperation, my mom picked up the paper, and in the paper in those days, they had an announcements section that most of the churches put their announcements, what to expect for that weekend. She picked it up, she read through it, and she called just about every church she could find in the newspaper and said, "Please pray." What she didn't know is that all of the churches already had a prayer network. There wasn't very much in the way of denominationalism in those days. All the churches spoke to each other everywhere. The country was in the middle of a civil war. Things like that didn't appear important. They all prayed. Every church, as far as I know, in the whole of the town prayed. The following day, several of the churches got together and they decided to send a delegation. A group of about 7 or 8 of them appeared and they prayed over my bedside. Saturday morning. The hospital adopted a wait and see attitude. My condition was so serious that they eventually took me off of this drug, experimental drug, because it was in such limited supply. Easter Saturday came and went. Following morning, Easter Sunday, was my birthday. I can still remember a little red tin fire engine that they gave me. I can also remember being prodded and poked by so many doctors I lost count. People in white coats, prodding, poking me, trying to get me to stand up, checking my glands, shining lights in my eyes. One of those things you don't forget, especially all the needles that they shoved into me. You don't forget things like that. Easter Monday. In the afternoon, The hospital called my parents, a little bit unexpected. They were concerned. What's wrong? What's the issue? The issue, according to the hospital, was that all the tests had come back. They couldn't actually find anything wrong with me. I was wasting bed space. Could they get me out of there?
Incredible. Beautiful.
That was in the course of a weekend. The doctors never did acknowledge what happened. They put it down to the experimental drug, in spite of the fact that they'd taken me off of the experimental drug. So convinced were they that the leukemia would come back, that I had medical tests, I had bone marrow lumbar punctures every 6 months until I was 10. But they couldn't do it in Rhodesia because they didn't have the right calibration equipment, so I had to go all the way down to the HF of Wood Hospital in South Africa every 6 months until I was 10. Eventually, they got bored of it, almost as bored as we were. And they said, okay, every 9 months, then every year. By the time I was in my mid-teens, my dad said to them, face facts, it's not coming back.
Amen.
So my story is one of a gracious God. It's not about me. It's not about how good my parents were. It's not even about how well the church has prayed. My parents were not believers at that point. I certainly didn't know much about what was going on. But I want to tell you, if God can move in the life of a child, it's important that you know that he still works today. If he can have compassion on me, he can have compassion on you, he can have compassion on anyone else. But I want to stress that the story is not about me. I want to stress that. The story is about how God dealt with me. See, I've never really shared this before, but some months after I came out of hospital, on a cold, wintry day, one morning I was feeling really cold. I was four and a half years old, and I happened to spy the family's electric bar heater. Plan, I'd seen it in operation before. I picked it up, I plugged it in, I turned it on at the wall, I turned around, I lost my balance, and I fell into it. My hand went right through the bars and into the element. It burnt off my fingertips completely. It almost electrocuted me. It gave me scars here that I will have for life, in spite of the skin grafts that I've had. Those scars are a constant reminder to me that although God saves, God is glorious in his mercy, we still face the consequences of the choices that we make. You see, it's only much later that I came to realize those scars are a reminder. God had done the work in my life, but it was his work. He saved me from death, and it's his story to tell. It's still about the relationship between me and him. It's about the relationship between you and him. We can't take him for granted. There really wasn't, there isn't anything special about me, any more than there's anything special about a bottle containing a fine wine or a cardboard box containing a great present. The fact is that sometimes he uses pain, sometimes he uses suffering to make his point. The Apostle Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12 that he had been given a thorn in his side to keep him humble about the revelations and the understanding that he had received. It wasn't his revelation. It wasn't because he was so great that God had given him this revelation. It was because God wanted us to know and was using Paul. And Paul had to be reminded. God's grace is such that he will work a miracle to bring us to him. He will use pain and suffering to show us how he works. He will bring glory to his own name. but he values the relationship between you and him too much to allow us to become conceited about it. Thank you.
Amen.